So, do you ever watch Binging with Babish?
I have, yeah.
Okay.
I like him.
Sorry, what?
I like him. He's just funny.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's funny too. And yeah, I've been watching quite a bit of it lately, but I don't know why. Like, I don't know. Like early on and near the beginning of his channel, I caught some videos sometimes, but I wasn't really into it for whatever reason. I don't know.
Totally.
I don't know if it was because it was a little too like layman for me or something.
Oh, get over yourself, Shell.
Yeah, that probably did sound elitist, but I didn't really mean it that way. I just mean like the content because of how he approaches things just didn't like grab me because I don't know. Because he was starting usually from a place of like not knowing much at all. And I think I found that tedious or something.
Well, I actually disagree with you. Like, not knowing much at all. Like, I think I've seen him make puff pastry from scratch to make a beef Wellington or something. Like, he seems like there's some pretty legitimate skills backing it up. And it's just the delivery is really dry and funny. I don't know. I really like a lot of the videos.
Like I said, Alan, I didn't watch enough of them to really understand why it was good. Like this is my own problem. I'm the one that's dumb. I didn't
Oh,
realize
chill.
that it was good. And it actually is good. Anyway, yeah, my bad. Babish good, Shale bad. Anyway, I've been watching quite a bit of it lately. And yeah, some of it's like some of his dish explorations are like really good. And like he really, I don't know, he's just very curious about why things work the way that they do. And he, you know, when something's not working, he like really is always trying to get to the bottom of why it's not working for him or
Yeah.
whatever. Which can be a little
But
bit frustrating if you understand the reasons why it isn't, but it's also funny to watch.
it's also kind of like he doesn't derail the episode if it's not working. Like he's still,
No.
you can tell he's on a schedule and like, I will
Yeah.
produce this video by the end of this day or this week or whatever.
Right.
But it's really charming to me. Like it's really, because when he points out that it's not working, it's usually quite subtle. Like it's not usually like the dishes look great and the technique seems very sound generally. But yeah, when it's not working exactly as he anticipated, he points it out and it's pretty funny actually.
Right. Yeah, he's got a great sense of humor. I think I really jive with his sort of like, you know, his kind of sarcastic or a little bit like abrasive sense of humor and his like his like ability to make a joke of getting frustrated in front of the camera. Like I
Right.
think those are some of the funniest moments when he gets like really frustrated and you can tell he's actually really frustrated, but he also thinks it's hilarious that he's frustrated. I don't know. It's pretty.
There's usually a funny juxtaposition of like, because the one of the conceits is that you never see his face in the videos, or maybe he does now, but like it used to be you would never
Yeah,
see
in
his
his newer
face. It was just
videos,
his.
like the ones where he's not producing a recipe, he like talks to the camera and
Oh,
stuff.
okay. But it used to be you would basically only see the workbench and his torso and his arms. And so sometimes like he would literally like he'd be shaking, his fists would be shaking. He was so disappointed. But
Yes.
then hit the voiceover, because
The
it's all kind
voiceover
of
would be
like
like
it's filmed, and then you can tell he does a later voiceover and it'd be like, oh, and then it doesn't quite work out the way you anticipated, but you can see like he's like
And then
punching
he's just
a
like,
piece of dough or something. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
yeah, he's pretty funny.
But the food looks great too, and like there's a handful of them that I have returned to a few times, including the gnocchi one, where it's just like he does a few different styles. He does a potato one, a ricotta one, a few different sauces, a few different shaping techniques, and it's just like really, it's enlightening. It's cool to see someone go through all of those steps and show so
Yeah.
many different iterations of the dish. So.
And really seemingly learn something and get something out of it.
Yeah, and it looks awesome. Like
Yeah.
it seems all very legit in terms of the
Yeah.
technique and the flavors and everything. So, yep,
Totally.
I'm a fan. I don't like own his any of his books or anything, but
Or any of his like sponsored kitchen equipment or anything like that.
no, is one of them a tiny whisk?
Oh, I don't know, maybe. That's like he has like pans and stuff now too, I think.
Oh, good.
Pans
for
and measuring
it's like
cups.
A running joke in some of the older age of videos he used to produce where he would always have a tiny whisk because they were so much effective in the tiny pots.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't really sympathize with it until we talked about this briefly, but when I was practicing for the CCC, the portion sizes are so small that you have to produce. It's like four portions of each thing. And so I'm like trying to like make beurre blanc, like, you know, like one cup of beurre blanc in this tiny little pot. And
in like a pot that will fit a whisk. Yeah.
My whisk doesn't even fit in the pot. And so I did actually like stress purchase a tiny whisk just to do that, to do that process. But
did it work out well?
Yep.
Great. I mean, you got your CCC, so I guess it was worth the whisk.
Exactly. Oh, I bought a lot of stuff, but anyways, that's different.
I've been watching quite a bit of it lately, and he has like ones where he ranks foods.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
so
what's an example?
Well, he did rank instant ramens was one of them.
He stole our bit.
I know. Unbelievable.
Bastard.
It's okay. He's got a different audience than we do.
There's a joke.
Just
there,
kidding. There's probably a lot of overlap, actually. And I think he did one.
What's the name for a Venn diagram where there's a little tiny circle that's fully subsumed by a much larger circle? Is that the...
Yeah, I think that's the same thing as like how whole numbers are subsumed by like real numbers or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be generous. But anyway, sorry. Yeah. What videos have you been watching?
Well, I watched one before we got on tonight where he was like ranking recipes that like his like group chat sent in, and they're weird snack recipes, and man, some of them are just like so god awful. A couple of them he just like gave them a zero and like lit them on fire,
like kind of in the
which
same
is pretty funny
in the vein of our TikTok episodes, like
sort of. Yeah, like a lot of it was like that, but like clearly not just like ripped from TikTok, but like recipes that people, their actual snacks that they make at home or like that they came up with or something.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, he like, there was some good ones too, but like the one thing that was so funny in it is like, there was one of the recipes was Gator wine, and it's like half blue Gatorade, half cheap wine. Okay. So like kind of like a Calimocho. Is that what that's called? Yeah. Kind of like a Calimocho, but yeah, with Gatorade instead of Coca-Cola. And he was just like so when he saw it and saw what it was going to be, he was just like so distressed. But then he tried it and he was like, oh, actually it's pretty good. It's like, you know, kind of like sangria or something. So he wound up like drinking it through like the whole episode, and right, it was really funny. It was pretty good. Anyway, so now I have a Gator wine in front of me.
Wait, right now?
No, I'm just kidding. Oh. I wish.
Blue Gatorade specifically is what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, light blue. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, don't knock until you try it.
Yeah, I'm curious. Although you have to also buy, like, there's two things that I never buy. It's like a bottle of wine that's like less than $12 and blue Gatorade. Like those, I'm not going to have those two things around.
You never buy a wine that's less than $12?
I buy sake that's around $12 for cooking with, but I don't buy a lot of wine.
Such a pompous ass. Just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. Like you have $12 wine in your house. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. How you doing, Alan?
Good.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. Thank you. Alan, do we have any follow-up?
I had one piece of follow-up that actually kind of really nicely ties into what we're going to talk about tonight.
Okay.
So I don't know. Do you have any non-sequential follow-up that you want to share first? Or
I don't know. Maybe we already talked about it, but tadpole tape cutters are not available in Canada, but there is another kind of tape cutter that looks similar. Someone sent a link to. And
I didn't see that.
I forget what it's called off the top of my head, but I'll include the link in the show notes. I want to try one out. But honestly, like, I watched a little video of how they're used on Amazon, and I think for me, I don't know, it just like seems a little more cumbersome than just like either writing on the roll and cutting it off with a pair of scissors, or just like putting a strip down on a table, making a bunch of labels and cutting them with a paring knife.
Yeah, I think cumbersome might be the word. It's a little, it's slow. And even if you do it perfectly, you end up with jagged edges because it's like a highly serrated.
Right, because the cutting blade is like serrated, yeah.
But the bigger thing is that like it might not actually be as fast as just doing your prep, putting out 3 feet of tape on the table and...
Yeah, and then just writing out a bunch of labels.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm still curious. I'm probably still going to order one and just see what it's like. But what about you? Any sequential follow-up?
Well, yeah, actually, now that you mention it, it dawned on me, we had, maybe it was two conversations ago, we had the conversation about menu standards by which you, that's the title of the conversation, but really you were talking about within each situation where you're trying to write a menu, you really have far more constraints than you might imagine for, you know, a dazzling creative chef. Like whether it be the concept that the ownership has and, you know, or the kitchen equipment and layout that you have, the staff that you have available to hire, all of these things like really dictate a lot of what you can cook. And I think that conversation,
access to ingredients,
lots of things. And that conversation specifically was focusing on like the customer expectations, but it dawned on me afterwards that, there's an excellent quote by a Canadian born architect, named Frank Geary.
Heard of him.
Who this entire quote was used as the basis for one of the presentations at, that Cook's Camp, conference that I attended 2 years ago, that we discussed.
Just happening here again soon, I think.
Yeah. It's usually, I think they usually have it like the beginning of September. And so I don't know, I don't have any of the details for this year's. But when I attended in 2022, there was a Vancouver chef named Angus N who gave a talk. I think it might've even been called 15% Creativity, but it was based on this Frank Geary quote, which goes, if you'll allow me, and keep in mind that he's an architect, not a chef, but he says, as an artist, I've got constraints. Gravity is one of them. Not as applicable for chefs as architects, but still applicable. Gravity is one of them. But within those constraints, I can find 15% of freedom to make my art. And so, yeah, Angus's interpretation of this was like, if you really thoroughly and rationally think about all of the constraints you have in a given project, you, even in the best times, you really only, or if you think about it properly, you really only have this amount of wiggle room, this 15%, which I thought, I think that like it kind of was in the back of my mind in our conversation about the menu standards, but like I never was quite able to put my finger on it. But like, I think that right. really does apply, right? That's kind of in a lot of ways what we were talking about, where it's like, if you really have to grapple with customer expectations and management expectations, like you don't have as much room as you might initially think. Is that a fair way to put it? Or?
Yeah, I think so. Well, and like, you know, there's like, if you're talking about like first principles, and Geary's referring to like gravity as like one thing that has to limit his creativity. You know, if you're trying to apply that to menu development, like there's, you know, the first thing is that everything has to be edible, right? And like you have to make food, right? And so that's already like really, well, I guess maybe in the case of some Italian restaurants, you don't start with that as a first principle, but like, you know, that's already, you know, reining in all of the potential possibilities. And even though that seems like a huge subset to start with, it's like, you know, a huge narrowing of like your toolbox and what you're working with or whatever. And then each one of those other things just like, yeah, pares that down more and more. And like each one of those constraints doesn't just like subtract, it like divides the amount of options that you have, you know? Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's an interesting observation. I also didn't know that Frank Geary was Canadian. That's pretty bad of me, right?
I don't know.
Or like Canadian born.
I think he's an American citizen now, but he was born in Canada.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Cool. Well, thanks, Alan. Is that all the follow-up?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. What do we got? What do we got for topics, Alan?
Okay. Well, the idea is this. Because I am transitioning to a new class to teach at Nate, which still, the new class still involves writing and serving a menu, but mm-hmm. I was reflecting on the menus that have been served in the class that I was teaching for the last 3 years. And especially in light of the conversations that we've had about menu ruts and menu standards, I was like, huh, yeah, I definitely have some things that I lean really heavy on. I thought it would be fun to look over. So it's six different menus. Like it was two menus a year for 3 years, to look at some of those and be able, and to point out some of the crutches that I had. And things that I return to again and again.
Oh, crutches. That's a good one. Yeah. I was going to say we should call it menu grooves, but I like crutches.
Well, grooves sounds way cooler than crutches, but...
Okay, we'll stick with grooves then.
It goes from very high-level things like the menu structure that I didn't have very much... Well, very high-level things like the menu structure down to like, you know, certain garnishes that just are there again and again and again, term over term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll call it a retrospective of your menu grooves.
That would be very kind of you. Thank
you. That would be generous.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I like this. It's like, you know, not looking at it as ruts necessarily, but like, I don't know. I think it's interesting to discuss, like, why do we have those things? You know, like, obviously, like, part of it is things like product availability but like probably a part of it is like the ease of doing something familiar where you don't have to rethink everything, you know, everything that you're going to do like Carmi does every single day before.
And I will say right off the hop, like I don't actually think it's very reasonable to, it's fine to reuse things like, because you know, we watch Netflix specials and YouTube videos and whatever else and see people who are operating at a level that we just don't need to behave that way or to produce that effect. Like for me, it's like I'm working at a culinary school. And so like there are a set of techniques and kind of industry standards that I should be exposing the students to. But then you watch Netflix and read the 11 Mass in Part cookbook and all this thing. That's like, you know, there are rules. Like one of the things that we talked about with the most recent season of The Bear is they say you never duplicate an ingredient on a given menu, that's, right? Which is insane. Like that's just a completely different, there's no restaurant in Edmonton that doesn't duplicate an ingredient on a menu. Like maybe they have sneaky ways of doing it, but
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it would be crazy to hold yourself to that in the context of, say, my job or really most of the cooking jobs in Edmonton. But it is always in the back of your mind, like that you want to try something new. Don't fall into a rut. But it is really funny to me to look back on the menus and be like, oh yeah, every single one has this and every single one has that. And yeah, I don't know, the tricks or the techniques serve their purpose, but it's almost embarrassing sometimes to be like, oh yeah, this is something that it's going to be on an Allen menu or whatever, but
right. Right. So how do you want to approach it? Did you put it all in a spreadsheet and then so that we know like how many instances of each one there are or what
you'll
how
have
are
to,
we going to,
there's no spreadsheet. You'll have to rely on me. Like I can give examples and I can name probably three or four dishes, use the ingredient or the technique or whatever it is. But the way that I think about it is kind of like from a top down, like there's really broad high end, like the structure of the menu, the proteins that must appear, and then going down to, yeah, like through the levels all the way down to like this garnish, I used every single menu in one way or another.
But, right.
Yeah.
So like a level down from menu structure might be like ingredients, and then the level down from ingredients might be preparations or something like that. Okay.
And somewhere in there, like to fit in like a plating, like in terms of, yeah, like the menu structure, the composition of the dishes, like in terms of how many components there are and what the components are. Certainly the proteins, the techniques, the plating techniques. Yeah, all the way to the garnishes.
Right.
There's a through line there in a lot of them.
Right. Okay, well, let's kick it off then.
So the first one, I actually don't want to like beat it to death because it's kind of obvious but not very interesting to discuss. Like the way that the menu was structured when I started in the class, it was six starters and six mains. And it's kind of because they're, as we've discussed before, it's like an operational service staff and then two live service culinary classes happening to do the dinner services.
Right.
It's all really enmeshed and works well for what we're doing, but there's the structure of the service is like high level three course, but there's an amuse-bouche and there'll be drink service, an appetizer, a palate cleanser, an entree, and a dessert. And
sounds like five courses now.
Well, three principal courses, whatever it is. And if you had to start from scratch and say like for me, you know, what's the most exciting dinner service that I've had in my life is probably, for instance, the dim sum style service at State Bird Provisions.
Oh man.
And that would be cool. It would be fun to try and do, but like, it's not really like there's a system that works as a structure to the service that works. And there's at least three unique groups of people who are involved in the service, namely like the operational service staff, the savory culinary arts students, and the baking and pastry arts students. So,
right.
That just works. And I wouldn't want to try and tear that down and build it up into anything different. But that is,
yeah, it would cause everybody else a lot of anxiety or something and to like, have to totally, but can you imagine if you came in one day and you were like, okay, we're throwing everything in the trash from now on. It's dim sum. What do we have for carts?
And actually, I don't know if you, I'm not sure if, like, cause you've dined there a few times,
twice
since I've been, but like there are semesters
like four or five times
where they have like the dessert service happens as a tableside cart service because of some of the learning outcomes that they have for different baking and pastry arts classes at different times of the year. And so maybe
so they do have carts.
They do have carts. Yeah, they only have two carts. But you didn't,
Alan. You got to get back in there. Some missed opportunity.
I mean, it'd be fun. But anyways, that's the like the high level. Like we're kind of operating in this kitchen as a everyone's going to get a starter and a main.
Right.
So that's the first thing.
Gotcha. I don't think that counts as a thing.
Okay, fine. But just like delete the... all the last 5 minutes. Just delete it.
I mean, I think it, yeah, I'm sure that you probably have the freedom to change that if you want, but I agree. Like, it would be difficult to change that without tearing down the structure of how that restaurant works, like in terms of training the service staff and what the customers expect. And, you know, like, right. It's just, you know.
Yeah. The next one, again, we've kind of talked about it before, and it's not the most interesting in this context, but the mains need to be based on protein. They need to feature protein. And there's really, in a way, only a handful of proteins that make sense in this context. So if there's six mains, one will be beef. And one thing that I... like, I don't need a prize for it or anything, Shil, but like, I did try and change the cut of beef every term. So we didn't, the kind of beef tenderloin is often the expectation in this kind of context. And there, and we did have beef tenderloin on the first term that I was teaching. But we changed the cut of beef every term. So we had.
Okay. Well, No, you've already declined it, but I'll hang on to this trophy just in case in the future.
Oh, thank you.
You feel like. Yeah.
But there needs to be beef. There needs to be poultry. There needs to be some, there's kind of like this nebulous idea of game in the North American fine dining concept where it's like, yeah, sure, duck is game and lamb is game and game is game. And so you need a couple of those sort of like it's,
lamb is game. I don't know.
No, sorry. Do you know what I mean? Like red meat.
I do know what you mean.
Red meat, that's not beef.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pork is a little bit of a dicey proposition, not dicey, but like it, I tried to sneak pork on wherever I could, but pork as an entree in a fine dining context can be, maybe there's not the perception of value there the way that there would be with red meat.
Right.
And of course there needs to be a vegetarian entree, perhaps.
And poultry.
Yeah. And poultry.
And fish. Where are we at, 9 now?
Yeah. 17 entrees. But I want to drill down into some of the like real, just things I leaned on real heavy.
I mean, like, I think that it's an interesting observation and a good way of putting it that maybe the value proposition of pork doesn't seem as like good to people or something. But man, it must really hurt your soul to have to question whether you're going to put pork on your menu as a main. I know you, Alan.
Yeah. And so the most successful ways we did it was like with beef, if it's tenderloin, like you just, you pan roast and, you know, you pan roast a tenderloin with butter and garlic and rosemary. And that's as much as you would ever want to do with it. With the pork, we found some like, I mean, this doesn't make sense in a fine dining context, but like some value added ways to make the pork more interesting where we like, I think the best selling pork dish we had as an entree was pork shoulder, like the copa of the pork shoulder, cured and smoked and braised and just basted to reheat. It sold extremely well. Like it, especially for, you know, like to see the words, I think it was on the menu, it was just pork shoulder.
Right.
And so that's not, doesn't sound very fine dining. But it was like smoked pork shoulder with, I think it was a potato roasty and all the things that you would expect me to serve with pork, applesauce and horseradish and stuff.
Things are on all on the dish every time.
Well, that's another rut kind of is like for me, pork, cabbage, apple. Like if I have like,
yeah,
And I would be happy to eat that every day at home. But, you know, if you're changing the menu twice a year, like, is it really always going to be pork, cabbage, apple? Even though that's a wonderful
Well, there's a lot of cuts of pork and there's a lot of kinds of cabbage. If you're in Denmark, there's a lot of kinds of apples. So
right. But so then do you... Well, this is the question. Like, do you... We know it's excellent and it's in a way timeless, but do you actually just do that forever? A different version of that?
Yeah, that's the real question, isn't it? I don't know. It's tough. Like, personally, I feel like for me, you know, when I'm doing my creative menu design, it's usually like I start with something like that. That's like a personal favorite, something that, you know, like that I could eat every day that I really love, or something like pork, cabbage, apple, right? But then I'm usually like looking for a good way to just swap out some of those things that I'm leaning on, but to bring a similar context or something to the dish, you know, right. Like if I'm going to take out the cabbage, I want to bring in something that does something similar to what the cabbage would do in the dish, you know,
some other brassica
or like, I don't know, like you get just off the top of my head, like you get so much umami from cabbage. Like I think that you could swap it with like mushrooms and do something like that. And you would get, you know, or something, I don't know, But like it's that's the whole question is like, you know, pork and cabbage is like one of your favorite things. Why deprive people of that, Alan?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Moving down. So from the menu structure into the plate composition, we have touched on this before, but I took this very narrow cue from the first 11 Madison Park cookbook, where like the last time that I worked in fine dining and industry, it was perfectly fine for a plate composition to be meat, starch, veg, sauce, garnish.
Right.
It's still perfectly fine. But when we started making and especially, it's funny, like, especially once I started seeing the plates that the pastry side was putting out, I was like, I think that these plates are too simple.
Right.
And I know that, again, like our recent conversation about The Bear, season 3 of The Bear, the entire menu development side of that story is about simplifying, like paring down to 2 or 3 ingredients and executing them well. But when I started making those plates, I was like, it doesn't seem like the same thing that the pastry crew is doing. And it didn't seem very well differentiated from what was being served for the slightly more casual lunch services and everything. So I cleaved to this idea of from the first 11 Madison Park cookbook, where it's like, we probably need, as a starting point, yes, a protein, a starch, a veg, but we probably need 2 sauces and we probably need 2 garnishes. Right. And I just like as a, like, not as a rule, but as a, like, when we plate it and we want it to look artful and we want there to be a lot of variation in texture and acidity and things like that, that became my starting point, where it's like, almost every plate, this is dumb shit, I'm like embarrassed to say this, almost every plate will have as a sauce a vegetable puree and some other kind of sauce, whether it's a reduction or a fluid gel, which was totally one of my crutches, or something like that. And almost every plate will have 2 garnishes, something crispy and something sour or pickled or something like that.
Right. This is still just the mains we're talking about, hey?
Principally, yeah. Like, certainly in terms of the conception of the mains, that was the idea. And so you ended up with, like maybe it's too convoluted or whatever, but to give an idea, like, we've talked a lot about the dry-aged duck dish from the most recent menu, where it's like, So obviously the protein is duck. The starch was these buttered grains. The vegetable was beets. But then we had two sauces. There was a duck reduction and a sour cherry fluid gel. And there were two garnishes. There was a crispy puffed wild rice and glacé cherries. And mm-hmm. so it ends like, I don't know, it was a good dish, but if it certainly doesn't fit within the line of thinking of, you know, those very austere and pared down dishes that we were talking about from the third season of The Bear.
Yeah. Or if you look at the like construction of the dishes in the first 11 Madison Park cookbook, I mean, like the thing that they don't have to worry about is having a protein, a veg, and a starch on every plate,
right?
So they can get away with having things look much more simplified because really most of the dishes that they're putting out are highlighting a single ingredient. Mm-hmm. And then you're putting something with one, or, you know, like you're putting something else with it to highlight that one ingredient, rather than you have to feature the protein and the starch and the veg on the plate. And then how do you make that all go together? And then by the time you add things to the dish to give it that textural range or the, you know, all of the flavor hits that you need, then you wind up with a lot of components, which I think is like, yeah, I think it's tough. Like, I don't think that you would have been able to get away with changing the menu so much that most of the mains didn't come with protein, starch, and veg, you know? Like,
right.
It's probably would have been a little bit of a revolt, you know?
But way different for like a three-course menu versus a tasting menu, right? Like where...
Yeah.
If you're only having courses, like appetizer can have interest, but the principal plate should have that balance of protein, starch, veg.
Yeah.
And obviously
dessert
is dessert.
I think like an interesting creative challenge within that structure would be to minimize the amount of ingredients that you're using, but just use them in different ways.
Right.
You know, so like, I forget what you said the crispy component on the duck dish was.
It was puffed wild rice,
yeah. You know, which goes well with duck, and that sounds great. But if you want to have a crispy component on that plate and you don't want to add additional ingredients to it, then maybe you could do crispy duck skin as a crispy component,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, like if you – and what was the veg? Beets,
yeah.
Did you say?
Yeah.
And then you sort of like pair the beets with cherry, like you have a...
Yep.
Yeah, which I think works really well together. I wouldn't necessarily take out one of those ingredients, but, you know, like you could, you know, have the beets and have them, you know, like have them in some kind of beet reduction sauce, and then also do a fluid gel of beet, but flavor it differently, like flavor it more acidic or something like that to... you know, bring in more flavors, but just still you're just highlighting the beets or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, you could use that as a framework to kind of focus on the ingredients that you wanted to highlight.
Right. But, yeah. Still have three or four core flavors, but then to kind of, parse them out into different textures and variations and stuff.
Yeah. Like what can we use from these ingredients that we're trying to highlight to bring the thing that's missing? If that's crispiness, then what, you know, what can we add as a crispy thing here or what? I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. There were some attempts at that. Like going back to the pork cabbage apple thing, like some really great, silky smooth apple sauce purees, and then trying mm-hmm. to like using the apple skins as the crispy component. But yeah, I do think that oftentimes it just like it devolved into we need something crispy and it's got to be Moroccan themed or whatever, and so we just add some other ingredient and add that. The ones in terms of like the base level prep and plate components, where I just, when I look back at the, you know, the photo reel, where I'm like, oh yeah, I did that a lot. The first one that jumps out at me, okay, so first we mentioned the vegetable purees, not just purees, but the we've talked about it before, but like the purees being drawn across the plate with the back of the spoon,
right,
to
right,
give yeah, this yeah. kind of axis of like this kind of backbone to the whole construction of the plate, where you can lay elements across this axis. That's one, right. Like I would bet that 3/4 of the dishes from the last 3 years have that as the starting point. Like where, and like students would be like, yep. Okay. Like every single plate, like the way that we remember how to plate this is we start with a puree and we draw it right. across the plate in one direction or the other. And I like it, like it's because it adds moisture when you're eating it, but and it adds like it kind of draws the ingredients out so you can see them all. But yeah, that was definitely something where it was just like, should it be on 75% of the plates?
Every plate. Yeah, should it be on multiple plates on the same menu? Like probably not, something like that. Yeah.
And I would say in the later menus, in the earlier menus, it really was like every plate had its own puree. And so the chef right. sauce station was like, they had to reheat 24 things or whatever for service.
That's not that bad. 24 things.
But then later it was kind of like, maybe we don't need to put it on the menu. And we've got maybe two purees. There's like a squash puree and an apple puree. And some of the plates get this and some of the plates get that. And, mm-hmm. But one of the huge ones for me was baby vegetables, which I think.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically baby cucumbers, which appeared on way more of my cold dishes, actually in some of the hot dishes than was reasonable. Baby peppers, like baby bell peppers.
Mm.
And then
those are cute.
This doesn't count as a baby vegetable, but, beach mushrooms, like shimeji mushrooms.
Oh yeah.
Pickled shimeji mushrooms. I just like, used like confetti in because they're so delicious but so cute, and they look like perfect tiny little mushrooms.
Yeah.
And yeah, I put them
people
everywhere.
Don't see them very often outside yeah. of restaurant context,
but they're readily available pretty readily available. And yeah, they like the baby cucumbers, just like slicing them into rounds and them being like the like marinating them and seasoning them, obviously, but like those being the like cool crunchy garnish to an appetizer, like lamb sausage or something in that vein. Or fish, like any kind of cold fish, like a trout rillette or something like that. Baby cucumber.
I don't know what the sustainability story is behind eating baby cucumbers all the time. Like it's probably better to eat grown-up cucumbers or something for the amount of energy that it takes to produce them or something.
But texture is so good.
Baby cucumbers, I love them so much, Alan.
Because they're adorable.
They're so great to work with. Like the skin is like, you don't have to like, you wouldn't want to peel them at all because the skin is just like such a great texture, and they're sweet and they're so crunchy and so fresh tasting. Yeah. Man.
But to be
just start a baby cucumber restaurant.
and the baby peppers, like they're again, like they just look exactly like you look at them and you understand exactly, you can picture them hanging on the plant.
Where were you getting them from? I haven't seen that wildly available.
Oh, is that right? Like so you can walk into any superstore in Alberta. I know you're boycotting superstores.
Oh, and buy those like little bags of them. Yeah, that's true. I guess
a little
I
like
seen them
a
there,
2-pound
yeah.
bag. But then there was, I can't remember if it was from Cisco or what, but there was a supplier that would give us that same brand.
Right, I get it.
Of mini bell peppers. But yeah, just because you can serve them whole and people look at them and understand exactly what they are and they can picture them on the plant. But the kind of trade-off is that you're removing some of the technique from the equation because you don't need to
right.
cut them even. Like you can, we had some fancy techniques, like we would lightly oil them and then char them with a blowtorch and skin them and everything. But like, you're not really practicing knife work and you're not really, you're not displaying as much technique when you just have these perfect little baby vegetables that you can roast or grill and then just chuck on a plate.
It's true.
But we did, and we stuffed them like kind of like Greek style or meze style. Mm-hmm.
I had some of those one time when I was there.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. But yeah, I definitely used them two more times than I should have as the featured vegetable on a main. And then the pickled beach mushrooms, I had just like this really banging pickling liquid recipe that had like soy and ginger and garlic and rice wine vinegar. Mm-hmm. And those mushrooms just got there. I don't think there was a menu that I put up that didn't have one dish, at least that used those little mushrooms, because they're so cute and tasty, and then just like that pop of acidity. And actually, in that vein, the other thing, one little trick that is actually also from the 11 Mass and Park cookbook was shallot petals.
Oh.
Like where
I don't think I ever saw that.
You did, because they were on the escabeche dish, like the in quotation marks escabeche, like mm-hmm. the onion custard that had the seafood on top had pickled shallots on it. But the idea, like, I'd made pickled shallots 100 times before starting at Nate, but the idea that you would cut a whole shallot in half and then kind of painstakingly tease apart,
separate
these perfect teardrop petals, and then pickle those, but not pickle them too much. Like, no, don't cook them too much, because then they become droopy, but pickle them so that they're still acidic, but have a little bit of crunch and preserve that shallot, teardrop shape.
Mm-hmm.
Those also, there was always an appetizer, usually an appetizer, sometimes an entree, that had those little babies on them.
Those are also really good, like grilled, with the edges grilled on a flat top.
Yeah, totally. Like if you,
or if you take them and put them under like a salamander,
if you
just grill the edges and
there was, I don't roast them remember exactly how it was served when you tasted it, but that the veal cheek that was a little bit undercooked when you had it.
Right.
I remember. As we can. Oh, I'm sure you'll never forget it. I'm sure, because it was undercooked. There was a couple different ways that we did it, but there were charred shallots on that dish, and my favorite way of doing it was to cut the shallots in half, really aggressively sear / burn the cut side of them.
The cut side.
Yeah. And then tease them apart once they were a little bit softened, and put those kind of petals on the plate.
Yeah, I do love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as long as they're cooked through and tender enough, then that char flavor, they can take a lot of that char flavor for sure.
For sure.
One of the other things, it's a little bit more broad, but especially early on, I was really obsessed with like making sure that everything had a kind of discernible geometric shape. And so I shunned things like lentils and loose grains and beans and things like that, and preferred preparations where you could where you could give them structure. So for instance, for potatoes, like I probably wouldn't just dump a bunch of, even if no matter how well they were prepared, we wouldn't just like put a handful of baby potatoes or like little gem potatoes on a plate. We would prefer something like a pavé.
Pavé, yeah. And so you can cut it into like a little cube or.
Yeah, or a couple of triangles or a little rectangle or whatever. And so that was one pavé in one form or another was on the menu again, two or three times more than it should have been, probably. Sometimes in the like luxurious, creamy, cheesy sense, and other times in more austere, like fried potato sense, but like a rectangle of thinly sliced layered potatoes. And I don't know what the solution is to that.
I mean, there's a lot of things that you can turn into pavé, but you know, and then the other thing with like doing things that are more sort of like loose or something is, well, you know, there's a couple of things that you can do to give yourself presentation options. Like one thing is like molds, right? So if you make grains and you bind them together with a sauce or something, then you can use a mold to make a geometric shape on the plate or whatever, even though it's something that you can then knock down with your fork or whatever and break that. you know, for something like loose grains or baby potatoes or something like that, you can like set up the plate in such a way that you take it, like that you can like flavor them really intensely so that you don't have to use as large an amount, like you get the effect that you want but with a smaller amount. And then, you know, make several little piles of them, and depending on how the plate is laid out or whatever, you can like, you know, start on one end with like a big kind of like circle of them or a big kind of like pile of them or something, and then work down and make smaller and smaller piles, or
right,
you know, like there's things that you can do with things that you want to plate that are loose to sort of like still give the presentation its own geometry without necessarily, you know, having to deal with like, well, you know, I put this down on the plate and it just sort of like falls wherever. It definitely takes more time to construct a plate like that, and that's obviously always a consideration, but but yeah, like there are things that you can do with that.
That was something that I like completely eschewed like at the start of my time at Nate, where I was like, why would you take one component and put it in two or
put
three
it in more
different
places than one? Yeah.
Yeah. Like I thought, yeah. I thought it was so contrived, but I 100% embraced it, especially when there was like a time where say some, like a featured item, like the protein, like say like rack of lamb, you cook a rack of lamb and you want to carve it and present the interior cut sides, where you have that built in, like, okay, there's two pieces of meat that we're putting on the plate. So maybe it makes sense that we'll like whatever the starch is, like maybe we'll put two pieces of that starch and lean up the protein. Like we did that all the time. But it was funny, like just, I don't know if it's just coming right out of more casual dining settings where it just seemed like, why would you do that? Like why would you complicate your life like that? But yeah,
it Alan, helped. It took 3 years, but now you got 16% creativity.
Yeah, exactly. And there's probably some silly examples of that, like taking that idea to the extreme.
Right. Yeah. I agree that it definitely, there are ways in which it could be contrived, but yeah, I don't know. Like it just, it really, yeah, I think it depends on the dish and obviously depends on the rest of the constraints in the restaurant, and it probably depends on the customer a little bit too, right? Like what's the customer perception going to be? Is the customer perception going to be that it is too fiddly? Well, then maybe you don't want to do that, but
right,
yeah.
But I mean, yeah, as long as it doesn't make it difficult to eat, they're probably not going to complain about, I mean, as long as the food comes out hot and it's well seasoned
and it looks nice,
yeah, and it looks nice, they're not going to complain about something like that unless it actually makes the dish difficult to eat. But
yeah, unless you have to eat the dish out of the chef's mouth or whatever.
Right. The ceramic impression of the chef's mouth. One of the ones that I did avoid, and maybe not for the best, but like I did avoid microgreens a lot. There was often a herb garnish, but it wasn't usually microgreens unless it had a flavor that was specifically dedicated to the rest of what was going on the plate.
Right.
Which
I think is totally fair. I don't really like the idea of like micro mix as just a way to look the plate, make the plate look better,
right,
or something like that. If you can find, you know, something micro that is the flavor that you want in the dish, then it can be a really good way to do that. But yeah, I don't really approve of just like microgreens mix or whatever.
One that is okay, so the first time that I ever saw fluid gel, you made it, or maybe you had me make it, I don't know. We made a raspberry fluid gel for some kind of, I think it was like a sweet hors d'oeuvre, I don't remember what the application was, and I was like, oh, that's
weird.
Could
we make it with agar?
Of course.
Yeah, okay.
And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I just forgot about it for 6 years.
Right. Until you were writing a menu for Ernest's, and then you were like,
well, well, actually the first menu, it had a turkey schnitzel on it, and I wanted to serve it with red currant. And I was like, how do I make a red in Austria, like schnitzel would typically be served with a red currant jelly or jam. Right. And I was like, well, how do I put that onto a plate and not just have it be like this weird lump of jelly and yeah. not have it melt on the plate
if it's actually jelly.
And I tried a bunch of stuff, including like trying to serve little like actual jelly set into a tiny like 1 ounce ramekin and put on the plate. And it just, I don't know, it just didn't work very well.
Right.
And then I don't know how, like someone hit me over the head with a 2x4 and was like, fluid gel, dude. And then I don't think after that first term, I don't think there was a menu that didn't have at least one fluid gel on it. Just because flavor pops and
it works so well. It's such an easy preparation. It's a cool thing. It's a cool tool for young chefs to learn and have in their toolbox. Like you can just make, you know, anything into sort of a coulis that like works really well, and you can make, you know, and you can kind of write with it on a plate or something.
A coulis with height and structure.
Yeah.
And so everything from, the red currant gel with turkey schnitzel to cranberry gel with a chicken galantine to cherry fluid gel with duck to Saskatoon fluid gel with mushrooms. Like it was just
right.
It was always there. Cause I love like fruit in savory dishes, like fruit and pork, fruit and duck, fruit and all that. And so, yeah,
it's funny. One of the owners of Kind has a real aversion to fruit being served with their savory food. And so, but you know, like it's a pretty normal thing, but, anytime like I'm making food for her or anytime someone starts talking about food with their savory dishes, I always think of Paulina.
Right. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Going back to pork and apple, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I for me too, I think like sweetness, and then that's a good natural way to get sweetness into your savory dish, you know, like, and tartness, like a lot of fruits have like sweet and tart aspects and those things work really well. I don't know. Works for me.
Same. So I would love to report that going into the fall term that the menu that I've written for the garde manger class, the appetizers, for the lunch service, I would love to report that, you know, I've shaken off all of these crutches, but the truth is,
oh boy,
right as of right now, the way I've drafted it, there are baby cucumbers, there are pickled shimeji mushrooms.
Oh my god!
What was the other? There's no baby bell peppers, but okay. Yeah, I'm just. There are pickled shallot petals.
I was wondering while we were having this conversation if like you were going to use this episode of the podcast as a document for yourself to be able to like sort of like rid yourself of these crutches that you're using or just use it as a way to remind yourself to steer clear of these things so that you could take back some of those percentages of creativity within that 15% that you wind up with. But maybe it's better to start with what you know and then
see.
Maybe you should go back and listen to this after the first semester and be like, okay, well maybe, you know,
sure.
Maybe I can find a different kind of mushrooms that I could pickle.
But they've got to be tiny. They've got to be tiny,
they gotta be cute.
Perfect baby cuties.
And available.
Yeah.
And not $50 a pound. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, because none of the dishes are duplicates. Like, I haven't made any of these dishes as they are before. But there's just, like, all these little components. Like, for instance, like, talking about purees. Like, almost... Mm-hmm. It's not even on the menu, but... There was one dish I really wanted a golden beet puree on that dish. And so it's like, okay, now we have golden beet puree, like a cold version of it in our cold table for service. So it's like,
sounds delicious.
Would, or would any of these dishes be improved by like a little swipe of golden beet puree on the base? Yeah, a couple of them. So yeah. There it goes. Yeah, so we'll see. I otherwise they're all fully original dishes, Shil. But
I know. I've heard the menu. It sounds delicious.
Yeah, we've posted sure, it's pictures amazing. Of it.
I can't wait for the fluid gel. I can't wait for how you're gonna well, work actually, fluid gel. Into
it's not. That's funny. Let me think. So as of right now, there's not a fluid gel. But another thing, like, and this came up. It kind of pained me a little bit when we talked about. We have an episode called. It's just called A Fancy Dinner Menu, and it's that
right.
That the so-called long dinner that we did. At Little Brick, and that was the introduction for me of this idea of the chicken liver mousse capped with fruit jelly, which we've talked about a dozen times already. Well, that's on one of the dishes. There's a charcuterie board where one of the components will be chicken liver mousse McDonald in a glass.
It can't say that on the menu.
I'll make it happen. The
don't. have I done my rant about pasta alla costa on the?
Yes, you have. Yeah,
on the podcast.
I don't remember what episode, okay. But have you been to Va yet?
No, I haven't, and I was going to on my last couple of days off, and I really want to. Yeah, they have some stuff that looks really great. Mm. Yeah,
different episode.
Have you?
I have. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh man, yeah, can't wait to talk about it.
Do you remember when you got to have the crab cappuccino at the Okanagan table dinner at Nate, right?
Yes. Yeah. I did. Yeah.
So we specifically bought tiny 2 or 3 ounce Bodum glass cappuccino cups for that.
Right.
The chicken liver mousse is served in those. So you can
oh man, that's so,
so,
so
that you can see the layers of the mousse,
the separation
and
of the layer,
the sour cherry. Yeah.
Man, people are going to love it, Alan. People are going to love that. It's such a good little bite to eat.
And a good vessel for it.
Food Court and access great bonus content by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/foodcourtpod. If subscriptions aren't your thing, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Food Court is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Your hosts are Alan Sedeby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan McDonald. To get new episodes on the day they're released, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from you all. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.